Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Michael Regan, who joins us to discuss a wide range of EPA actions during the Biden administration. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Department of Agriculture enrolled a little more than 2 million acres into the Conservation Reserve Program through its latest general sign-up. USDA says producers submitted re-enrollment offers for just over half the expiring acres, keeping pace with the 2021 figures on the subject. In total, about 22.1 million acres are currently enrolled in the program, well below the 27 million acre cap for the fiscal year set to begin later this year in October. More acres are expected to be added to the program through the Grasslands CRP signup, which wraps up May 13th. The White House says it plans to convene hunger and nutrition conversations over the next few months with a larger conversation in September. The Biden administration announced it will convene a White House conference on hunger, nutrition, and health later this year. There will also be a handful of listening sessions leading up to the event, with the goal of developing a coordinated strategy to end hunger and boost healthy lifestyles by 2030. The last time the conference happened was during the Nixon administration and led to nutrition breakthroughs such as the Women, Infants, and Children program. And finally, the Environmental Protection Agency submitted biofuel mandate blending targets for interagency review this week. The move sets the stage for the finalization of long-awaited volumes for 2021 and 2022. Biofuel industry groups are also calling on the EPA to abandon its proposed plans to tweak the previously finalized targets for 2020. The agency is under a consent decree to finalize the volumes by the 3rd of June. When we spoke to Regan, we asked him, when the volumes are finalized, will biofuel groups like what they see?
You know, Spencer, we've spent a lot of time having conversations with the members of the industry. I spent quite a bit of time with Secretary Vilsack on this topic. And first and foremost, we want to get the program back on track. There has been a lack of certainty with these RVOs for a number of years. We've presented 3 years, 2020, 2021, 2022. And that year of 2022 is that upward trajectory that the industry has been asking for so long. So yes, we believe that the industry will see the strategy in getting the program back on track and looking at 2022 being that jump off point. By the way, the president indicated from day one that biofuels would be a part of the climate solution, and especially advanced biofuels. So as we get beyond these 2020, 2021, and 2022 RVOs and look at 2023 and beyond, we believe the future for biofuels is bright.
So as we look at that future, though, we also have to keep something from the past in mind, and that is the fact that we're dealing with a situation right now of these RVOs being put out under a missed delay scenario. We saw the Trump administration missed delays. We saw the Obama administration missed delays. You can't pin this issue on any one administration, any one party. It's been kind of a long-running issue with this program. What are you doing to make sure that going forward, the deadlines in the program are upheld and can be met?
Doing what we're currently doing, which is taking it more seriously than previous administrations ever have. Strong partnership with the USDA, a lot of outreach with the industry, and setting RVOs in a way that looks at multiple years at a time to provide certainty. So yes, we had to go back and clean up a little bit with 2020 and 2021 because the previous administration just didn't get the job done. 2022, I would say, is an aggressive year. And then we're already focused on 2023 and beyond. We're playing a little bit of catch up. The difference is you have a president that has said ag will have a seat at the table. Advanced biofuels is part of the solution. We've got to honor that commitment. And so we're engaging and we're staying on track.
So sticking with biofuels, and I want to ask you about some other topics as well, but sticking with biofuels for a moment here, obviously the RVOs are important, but also we've seen the Biden administration take some action on E15 as well, given the summer emergency relief that the agency has officially enacted. But there's been a push for a permanent fix for a while since there was that circuit court decision. Wondering from the chair you're sitting in, is the Biden administration interested in a permanent fix via regulation, maybe via the state waivers that some governors have sent you a letter about? Or is this something you would prefer Capitol Hill would codify into law?
Listen, I'd say that the president has pledged to use all the tools in his toolbox to, number one, advance biofuels. But number two, we know that Russia's unprovoked war on Ukraine, number one, is terrible for the country of Ukraine and its people, but the world is feeling the ripple effects. And the president pledged that he would do all that he could to help relieve that pressure at the pump and ensure that there were no interruptions in our supply. So our E15 waiver is honoring the president's commitment, and we are providing an option so that there is no disruption, but that there is also more options for people in our rural communities. Over 2,300 gas stations will now be able to service our rural communities because of our waiver decision. So we're focused on that. We know, and we've done the analysis, there are no adverse air quality impacts from the decision that we've made. But let's be honest, on year-round sale of E15, the previous administration attempted to do something that was outside of the bounds of the Clean Air Act. The court spoke to that. So we have to be very thoughtful about the role of E15 as we move forward. And I want to be very thoughtful about how I approach that topic. I can say that we are in constant conversation with lots of governors. And so we're laser focused on this topic.
We'll be right back with more from Administrator Regan right after this.
It's not as simple just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back. Biofuels obviously play such a critical role in the food and agriculture industry's view of the Environmental Protection Agency, but there are also several other critical programs that the agency does so key to farmers and ranchers. One such effort is the pesticide review process, and Administrator Regan says that's an area where the agency could use some help from Capitol Hill.
When you look at history, and this agency has always struggled with the Endangered Species Act, has always struggled with staying on track, has always struggled with resource needs. We need for Congress to give us the appropriate level of resources to keep track with a growing economy. We don't want the courts dictating to us which pesticides and herbicides should be on and off the market. We want science to dictate that. We want to work with our agricultural industry so that if we have a product that needs to be taken off the market, we have the resources in place to put a new product on the market. So we need the resources, and we need for Congress to appropriate those resources. We just released a strategic plan that really outlines how we plan to play catch up, the partnership with the industry, and why we also don't like being under the thumb of the courts. It's not good for EPA, it's not good for the science, it's not good for the markets. So we've got some thoughts about how to dig out of this hole. We need for Congress to step up, give us the resources so that we can keep pace with the farmers and ranchers' needs, so that we can keep moving with food, fiber, and fuels.
Well, and you talk about the needs of that farmer and rancher. They say that they need some crop protection chemicals available to them, and some of them are concerned about, perhaps the proverbial rug being pulled out from under them in terms of the availability of a product. Your message to growers concerned about the availability of some crop protection tools, potentially being removed due to cancellation due to environmental issues, ESA issues, and the like?
I do. I'm just as frustrated when a court steps in, like the court did on chlorpyrifos, and sets a litmus test that we can't meet scientifically, which means the product has to come off the market. That's frustrating for everyone involved. That's not something that EPA volunteered to do. That's something that the court directed us to do, and that we had to meet that moment. So it's important for all of our stakeholders to understand that when you're behind the eight ball and the courts really are dictating the pace, that's not good for any of us. And we want to work on a strategic plan to get ahead of this. And that does require additional resources.
I want to wrap up with another topic I'm sure that's going to be very familiar to you. That is, of course, the Waters of the U.S. rule, that interpretation of the jurisdiction of the Clean Water Act. Farm groups say they want to be able to sit, they want their members to be able to sit in a pickup truck and know if they've got a Water of the U.S. in front of them. As the EPA undertakes its updated rulemaking, is that a threshold the agency is going to be able to meet?
Simplicity and durability and certainty are absolutely the goals. As I've traveled the country with Secretary Vilsack talking about the bipartisan infrastructure law and our rural economic development and all of our rural investments, the creation of the Rural Partnership Network, we are laser focused on the needs and the concerns of our rural constituency. And as we look at Waters of the U.S., you know, we want to provide durability and certainty. For over a decade, our farmers and ranchers have not had certainty. And so what we've done is we've embarked upon a rulemaking process that has thoroughly engaged this industry. And we're taking this rule back to pre-2015. We're codifying some of the Supreme Court's rulings as of late. We're keeping in all of those pragmatic exemptions and exclusions that our farmers and ranchers and growers need. And we're trying to codify that in a way that gives them some certainty. There are decisions that are being made right now on a daily basis that are being done without our farmers and ranchers having that level of certainty. So I feel an obligation to continue to listen. We're gonna have regional roundtables all across this country led by our local ag industry stakeholders, the Farm Bureau and others. We're gonna continue to take that in. And when we do finalize our rule, we believe it will be one that will be much more durable, provide certainty. And by the way, my partnership with USDA, we want to have the resources out there so that our farmers can understand the regulations that we've chosen.
I want to wrap up on this line of thinking, because I've heard you in some of the various trips that you've taken to Capitol Hill defend the agency's action to move forward with this rulemaking process, even as the Supreme Court hears a case later this year that will potentially have some jurisdictional changes to the Clean Water Act. And you said you don't want to lose the time between now and then when the agency could be doing work on a new rule. It would just not be a good use of staff resources to not be working on it right now. But I'll ask you this, Mr. Administrator, are you and the agency not going to have to then update this new rulemaking that you're doing once the language from the Supreme Court is more familiar? Will that not also be an expansion of staff resources there as well?
It won't. There's a big, significant difference in getting a product in place that might need updating or massaging. You know, there's a lot of bureaucracy here, let's just be honest. And stopping the clock and waiting for the Supreme Court rule on the Sackett case would not be the best use of any of our time in terms of getting to that level of certainty. The reason being is the Sackett case won't address all of the concerns that we are addressing through our proposed rulemaking. So what we need to do is get as far as we can with as pragmatic of a rule as possible to begin to provide that certainty and durability and be positioned to adjust to the Sackett case. At the end of the day, we're going to respond to whatever the Supreme Court ruling is, but we're going to be in a position to respond to that ruling and have a product in place much quicker that will give the farmers and ranchers and our rural constituencies that level of certainty that they've been asking for more than a decade.
Mm-hmm. A lot of things on the agenda at the Environmental Protection Agency, so critical to food and agriculture. And Administrator Regan, we appreciate the time you've given us to discuss them here today.
Hey, I appreciate you having me on the show.
We'll be right back to hear from our panel. But first, Hannah Pegel takes a look at some big changes in ag input prices in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Producers around the country have been hit hard by rising input costs, but one input has surged in price more than others. That input is fertilizer. According to USDA's Economic Research Service, fertilizer makes up an average of 36% of a farmer's operating costs for corn, 35% for wheat, and 30% for sorghum. In late 2021, fertilizer prices began to spike alongside rising prices of natural gas, which is a primary input in nitrogen fertilizer production. U.S. farmers use three primary forms of nitrogen fertilizer: anhydrous ammonia, urea, and liquid nitrogen. In the last 12 months, prices of anhydrous ammonia have shot up 179%, with potash increasing more than 107%, and diammonium phosphate jumping 51%. A 100% increase represents a doubling of price. Therefore, the prices of anhydrous ammonia and potash more than doubled in the last 12 months. Diesel prices also sharply increased by 47%. As farmers gear up for the next planting season, the rise in input costs is expected to raise the break-even price for corn 25%. The same factors will raise the soybean break-even price 15%. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together, we celebrate together, but we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Happy to be joined this week by a group of people who deal with EPA on a wide variety of issues, from biofuels to water and land regulations to the pesticide approval process, hoping to get a good cross-section of industry views here on this Biden administration Environmental Protection Agency. And joined this week by Chris Liley with Growth Energy, Richard Gupton with the Agricultural Retailers Association, and Michael Formica with the National Pork Producers Council. Gentlemen, appreciate the time here today. Chris, I want to go to you first because we've seen the Biden administration take some action on the usage this summer of E15, but that's a 2022 fix. Folks looking for a 2023 fix, viewing that as either a regulatory fix or something that could happen through Congress. I guess I'm just curious, does the industry have a preference how this is approached on a more permanent basis, or is this just something you would like to see done?
Well, I think, Spencer, you hit the nail right on the head. This is something that we just need to see done to provide as much certainty as possible to the marketplace, to the nearly 2,700 retailers who are selling E15 today, as well as going forward into the future. We were certainly pleased with the president's stop at the Poet Biorefinery in Menlo and his commitment towards summer sales of E15, and then EPA's follow through just last week to provide the RVP waiver to allow summer sales beginning on May 1st for suppliers, and then what we hope will extend throughout this summer. As we don't necessarily have a preference, we just know we need a larger national solution to allow this fuel to be sold because we know it's less expensive, provides better air quality, and gives real consumer choice at the pump.
So when you say you're looking for a national solution, there's been eight governors that sent a letter to the administration looking for some flexibility there. Would that be satisfactory, you know, just giving kind of punching the ticket in that particular region, or would you prefer a more national solution?
Oh, we're strongly supportive of the eight governors who have notified EPA of their intent to opt out. This would provide a permanent solution for those eight states. It's roughly 1,400 retailers in those states alone that sell today. And this would provide a permanent solution for those states moving forward. But we need a solution beyond that for the other retailers that are selling today, as well as for growth well into the future. And so we're very supportive of what the governors have done. I know other states are potentially looking at this, but we also need a solution in place for some of those states that may not go this route, and those locations that are going to continue to sell in 2023 and beyond.
So as we shift the conversation to the Waters of the U.S. rule here, Michael, obviously the administration and Administrator Regan has been pressed on this issue on Capitol Hill. They seem fairly determined to keep pursuing their work as the agency awaits, as we all wait, really, the ruling from the Supreme Court, from arguments that are expected to take place later this year. If the EPA is going to keep working toward a Waters of the U.S. definition amidst the Supreme Court's debates, is there something that you would like to see them do procedurally? Are there boxes you would like them to check that would make you happy as someone who is pushing for a certain definition of Waters of the U.S. that, you know, might be influenced by the Sackett case?
Sure. Well, we would like to see them slow down the process, and really they ought to put a pause on it at this point. As you said, the Sackett case is going to be heard this coming fall. The opinion that comes out of Sackett is going to have a tremendous impact on how exactly EPA can define what a water of the United States is. And what farmers are looking for, and really what any business is looking for, is some level of certainty. Producers want to know what they're required to do. And if you give them clear directions, then they'll manage their farms to meet those requirements. And what we have not had for the last 15 or 20 years is anything close to certainty. We've had multiple versions of WOTUS back and forth. We've had conflicting opinions from both EPA as well as the Army Corps of Engineers, who also share jurisdiction here. And we've had a very troublesome and difficult to discern Supreme Court decision, earlier that has sort of created this mess. Hopefully a Supreme Court comes back and we get a decision in Sackett that provides, some clarity, clarity to farmers, clarity to business landowners, as well as to the agencies charged with implementing the Clean Water Act. Until they know what the Supreme Court is going to say, it really is just a waste of time and resources that could be better spent on things like providing E15 for drivers across the country. Why come out? Why spend all the time and resources? Have all these regional hearings? Bring people all over the country to draft a rule that you're just going to have to redraft come January.
Mm-hmm. Well, in another area where there's been resource concerns that the administrator has been fairly vocal about is in the area of the pesticide review and approval process. And Richard, I want to bring you into the fold for the conversation here, because obviously that's been a point of contention, the amount of time some of these approvals can take. So I guess I'm just curious if you can put in context, if you were to start the process for approval tomorrow, what's the amount of time that you're anticipating that approval process to take, and what's the financial commitment that you think something like that will take on the part of a company?
Well, a company the timeline from when they start development of a product and do all investment, the research to show the data that it can be used in a safe manner, not only for human health but the environment and endangered species, it takes 10 to 15 years, and they're spending tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in investment on those products. And what's concerning to us is some of the uncertainty that's been created on the recent rulings with products like chlorpyrifos, or you look at dicamba, or the litigation related to glyphosate. And so with all of that, and it's a common theme here with the speakers, is our industry needs certainty. We need as many tools in the toolbox for these products, and we need that certainty for companies to make the investment in future products that are going to be vital as we move forward, because there's going to be additional pressures, whether it's insect or weed or other types of things impacting crops, and they need the investment in those newer technologies. And we want to make sure that the agency is well funded. They have been haven't had enough funding for the Office of Pesticide Programs, and they're understaffed. And so we do support making sure there's a robust funding for the agency. That particular agency, Office of Pesticide Programs, to do the research and make those decisions, because again, it is critical. And if you don't have the staff as well, then they're going to be just continued delays, and you're going to have companies not making the necessary investments for newer technologies.
We'll be right back with more from our panel right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. The EPA has a wide range of programs that it implements, including several so critical to food and agriculture. When we asked our panel what they were looking for from EPA, there were some specifics particular to each individual category, but one overwhelming theme between the three guests. They'd like some certainty. Michael, as we shift back to WOTUS, there appears to be a intent on the part of EPA to create sort of a middle ground definition that will satisfy both the agricultural organizations and the environmental groups. And I guess I'm curious your perspective. Is that possible to satisfy both of those communities, or is the agency working toward an impossible outcome?
I have always, I guess it depends on who you define as the environmental organization. Going back 15 years on this issue, I've always thought there was a middle ground that agriculture could meet with the hunting and fishing community. There are concerns by environmental organizations over a variety of water quality issues that don't involve agriculture. I think there's always an opportunity for a middle ground compromise. I'd be interested to see where EPA ultimately comes down on this. But many of the activist groups, the environmental groups that are focused on agriculture, they really want to control the means of production. They want to control land use decisions, planting decisions, tell a farmer what they can plant and how they can fertilize it, what kind of crop protectants they can use. For my members, hog farmers, they want to tell them, how they raise the animals, what the inside of their barns look like, what kind of, veterinary care they provide to the animals. And all of that can be implicated by an expansive definition of WOTUS that captures upland, uplands. And we'll, ultimately we'll have to see where they come down with this. And like I said, the Supreme Court's is going to give us new opinion and new direction. And it seems wasteful for them to be spending all this time and effort at this point when we know the playing field is going to change in January.
And Chris, we saw action here pretty recently with EPA submitting the upcoming renewable volume obligations for interagency review. But I'm curious, do you think the agency heard Growth Energy and other similarly aligned groups with your thoughts on the 2020 revisions that the agency proposed on some of those volumes? Do you think you've been heard, and do you think that's something that will still be included in the final rule?
Well, it's always difficult to change a proposal, and I certainly think that we have made our voice heard as an industry, both collectively as a biofuels industry and ag as well. I think really importantly, and you saw that we entered into a consent decree with EPA that was approved by the court to get those volumes out. I mean, we need, and everyone on the panel has talked about certainty. The really important thing is that the RVOs get finished, especially for 2022. 2022 is the strongest volume we've ever seen. And so we want that finalized as quickly as possible, really to drive growth for biofuels moving forward. Certainly the revisions to 2020 and 2021, we have asked and we're continuing to push that they address. I mean, for 2020, it's really just leave what was in place alone. It was finalized in 2019. And so that should just remain in place. For 2021, certainly they should do more to drive renewable fuel blending rather than just look backwards at what was blended and frankly set volumes even lower than that.
Mm-hmm. Richard, I want to wrap up the conversation with you here because obviously you're going to be a lot more familiar with the approval process, really with the functionings of the agency as a whole than I suppose the average person. And we've talked a little bit here in our conversation about EPA's current resources, its staff allocation, et cetera. When we're looking specifically at that review process, how is the current staffing level, the current resource level at EPA, how is that impacting the timeline and the various approval processes that EPA is going through?
It could have a big impact on the timeline. If they just recently released their work plan to deal with endangered species. And if I mentioned the litigation, there's a number of NGOs that have sued EPA saying they haven't followed the process as far as the consultation process with the other agencies related to Endangered Species Act and Pesticide Registration Review. And so they're understaffed by several hundred employees that are going to be needed to make these registration reviews moving forward. And we're part of a broader coalition that supports legislation called the PREA, the Pesticide Registration and Product Improvement Act, that provides that funding from the registrants to make sure they have the adequate staff. And so the pressures are only going to continue on EPA to try to make sure there's a registration process that's done in a timely manner. And so that is a major concern, and that's highlighted again from their recent ESA work plan, and the kind of pressures they're going to be under for the timelines that are going to have to be met by the agency to have these, make sure these products are reviewed and re-registered in a timely way.
Well, obviously, the folks will know that the Department of Agriculture obviously is so critical to the nation's farmers and ranchers, but the Environmental Protection Agency playing seemingly a bigger and bigger role every day in the day-to-day operations of the nation's producers. And Chris, Richard, and Michael, we appreciate you joining us to discuss just what that role looks like and what you'd like that role to look like going forward. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers, but first, Hannah Pagel takes a look at the global palm oil industry in this week's Map It Out.
The Russian military has cut off Ukraine's ability to export sunflower oil and wheat, two of Ukraine's most highly sought after commodities. This has further accelerated a global food crisis around the world, causing price increases and food shortages. Analysts are looking closely at global shortages and price spikes around vegetable oil supplies, specifically palm oil. Just last week, Indonesia announced it would ban palm oil exports to other nations and protect its domestic industry. Keep in mind, global supplies of vegetable oil were tight well before the Russian invasion of Ukraine. This is because a 2021 drought in Canada impacted its canola crop. Plus, the demand for soybean oil-based renewable diesel has risen as more companies look for climate-friendly fuel supplies. When we specifically look at palm oil, it's important to understand how widely this ingredient is used across the globe. This map shows us palm oil imports and which countries rely on the commodity. Palm oil is used to make a variety of consumer products. It's in everything from pizza, donuts, and chocolate, to deodorant, shampoo, toothpaste, and lipstick. It's also used in animal feed and as a biofuel in many parts of the world. Indonesia, together with Malaysia, exports 92% of the palm oil on the international market. The announcement last week caused a 7.5% price increase, and since the beginning of the year, palm oil prices are up 75%. As of right now, it's unclear how long Indonesia intends to keep the palm oil export ban in place. Grow Intelligence, a data analytics company, says it doesn't believe the country can maintain the export ban for too long because of storage constraints. If you want to learn more about the vegetable oil crisis and the impact it will have globally, head to agripulse.com and read Bill Thompson's story. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at agripulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee will have an oversight hearing looking into the White House Council on Environmental Quality. USDA will release a new World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates report and wrap up its grasslands CRP signup. As it often goes in farm policy, there's almost certain to be more news and developments that will unfold, and we'll keep a close eye on it all at agripulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit agripulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.